just to quickly thank everyone for taking the time to come out today. Our partners from Fair Trials International have come all the way across the Atlantic, and so their presence here is especially appreciated. I know that some of you all have also come from quite far away. I'll let Jago from Fair Trials introduce the rest of our speakers and our topic today. I just want to make a couple of quick housekeeping notes, the first being that we're going to be on the record today, so keep that in mind. We're not video streaming, but we will have video up online at some point after the event. I just want to thank quickly also all the catering and AV and facilities folks who make all of these events possible. They do a great deal of work. And then I know that I think we're going to have opportunities for questions and answers later on in the program, and just to make sure that everybody takes a moment to introduce themselves and their affiliations, so that we know who's participating in the conversation. And with that, thank you very much again on behalf of Georgetown Law. I think I've been as quick as possible. And Jago, if you want to take over from here.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks very much. And thanks to Georgetown Law Human Rights Institute for hosting the event this evening. I should start with a few words of introduction, because as Patrick mentioned, we've come from across the Atlantic. We're not an organization with a presence in the U.S. Right now. So just a few words about the organization Fair Trials. We're a non-governmental organization. We're not party political. We're cross-party, non-party. We have no political axe to grind whatsoever. We're not funded by any domestic government. And we're not anarchist. You know, we believe fair and effective criminal justice systems are important. You know, we're not anti-criminal law. And in fact, this whole issue around Interpol, as you'll see during the discussions, it's really for us about how you marry up proper protections for human rights with effective law enforcement, which is, of course, absolutely crucial. So we have a pretty full panel of speakers and somebody else who's flying in right now, I hope. So I'll keep it brief. I want to just set the context really in terms of the issue of Interpol, introduce a couple of the phrases that you might hear during the presentations. So this is what most people think about when they think about Interpol. James Bond, you know, it's the exciting stuff. It's the good guys, you know, flying around the world fighting dangerous criminals. You know, whichever it is, for me, I don't know if it's crossed the Atlantic yet, but the Nordic noir crime dramas are a big thing over in Europe. And, you know, you can barely watch an episode of those without somebody talking about the guys at Interpol helping to arrest somebody, or, you know, the important crime-fighting work that they do. That's the way that Interpol is perceived in the general consciousness. You know, a hugely important crime-fighting tool. And some of that's absolutely true. The vast majority of Interpol's work we have no problem with whatsoever. It's an incredibly important organization, connecting police across the globe to make the world a safer place. That's their vision. And it plays a really important role. There's no question about that whatsoever. But the portrayal of Interpol in the movies isn't entirely accurate either. So first of all, it's not a global police force. You don't have Interpol police officers traveling all over the globe arresting criminals. What Interpol does is it connects the world's police. At its core, it's really information sharing. And one of the key tools is something called the red notice or the diffusion. You might hear these phrases, red notices, diffusions. It's about it's a way of issuing a global wanted person poster. You know those old posters that you see from the Wild West films, wanted criminal. It's the modern digital version of that. And what happens is a country requests one of these wanted person alerts, and it's circulated across all of Interpol's 190 member countries. 190 member countries. That's almost the entire world is a member of Interpol, and that's one of Interpol's real strengths. But as we'll see during the course of the presentations today, it's also one of the big challenges for Interpol, because Interpol operates on the basis that all of its member countries can be trusted to respect the rule of law, that all of its member countries won't misuse criminal justice systems for political purposes or abuse human rights. And really that's at the core of this problem. It's this assumption of trust around the membership of Interpol. And as I think lots of us know in this room, there are many countries in the world where you can't have blind faith that the rule of law is always being done, that criminal justice is not being abused for political purposes. I want to show you a very short film we produced to introduce this topic, to give you some context.
I thought Interpol was the international police force that went around catching drug dealers and fugitives.
I didn't know what an Interpol red notice was, so I like, got on the internet straight away.
When an Interpol red notice is issued, it means that you can't travel anymore. It means that banks will end their relationships with you. It means that basically your life as a normal human being is over.
Next morning, 5 a.m., the door opened and the squad of anti-terrorist police rushed in and I called my name.
The Department of Homeland Security contacted my employer before my U.S. visa was revoked. I was told by my manager that I was put on Interpol due to an unfunded check.
I was terrified. I was in a foreign country. I had to return home. And I thought as soon as my passport was checked, it would flag the system and I would be arrested.
I was arrested just in the face of other people present in the room and put in the handcuffs.
For us as a lawyer, it's becoming quite frustrating because we just have no entry point to start any form of dialogue with Interpol.
It was like they had like lots of information, but I didn't have any.
There is no person to contact. There is no nobody at Interpol we can call.
And the worst part about it is that if you want to appeal any decision, there's no court you can go to.
That film gives you a brief introduction. Basically, as explained in the film, and there were just three case studies there. There are three cases there in that film. Some, one you may have heard of, Bill Browder, an American-British businessman, investor, the biggest investor in Russia. And his case really helped to bring to the fore this question of abuses of the Interpol system. In fact, he's just published his book on the issue and decided to call it Red Notice. What happened was that Russia tried to use Interpol as a way of stopping Bill Browder's campaign to try and get justice for his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, and I think one of our speakers later in the session will talk about that case. There are a couple of other cases there, and there's more information about them on our website, including that film that it started to play automatically. We're going to hear from a number of people this evening who have been affected personally by this abuse of Interpol, because as I say, Interpol, while in the vast majority of cases, in many cases, is being used for perfectly legitimate purposes to chase down drug traffickers and terrorists. Sadly, a number of cases of human rights defenders, of journalists, and of peaceful political activists are being caught up in Interpol systems. And really, we need to start trying to raise awareness of the problem in the US, and that's the reason for this event. Why? Because the US is the biggest investor in Interpol. The US has invested a huge amount, both financially, but also in terms of the investment of staff time within US crime-fighting agencies to try and make Interpol an effective organization. We really need to try and get the issue of these abuses of Interpol onto the agenda in the United States so that the US can help encourage and support Interpol in introducing what we think a simple reform. So why are these cases slipping through the net? A couple slipping through the net, and why are these abusive global wanted person alerts getting onto systems? There are three very brief reasons, and we've written a huge report explaining this, so I will keep it very brief. The first is quantity over quality. So Interpol used to issue about 2,000 red notices a year. Just about 10 years ago, that was the situation. It's now issuing over 10,000 red notices a year. And it really seems to be measuring its effectiveness by reference to how much information is circulating. Another big reason is speed over diligence. Interpol has understandably tried to make it as quick as possible for police forces to circulate information globally so that you can catch wanted criminals in real time. But there are problems there too. There are problems because you can only operate that kind of super quick system if you trust all member countries not to abuse it. And of course, if you've got 190 member countries, including some of the most corrupt countries in the world, you can't trust them all not to be abusing the system. So Interpol got into a situation where it was allowing countries to circulate information around the world without any review at all by Interpol before that circulation was happening. We'll come to it later, but that is starting to change, which is good news. And the final thing is that the final cause for these problems is that Interpol is operating in a legal black hole. So if you think on a domestic level, if you are wrongfully arrested by the police here in the US, you have an avenue. You can challenge that police action in the courts. The problem with Interpol as an international organization is it has insulated itself from legal action. So if you are the victim of an abusive red notice, of an abusive alert, as Bill Browder said in that short film, there is no court you can go to. You have to write to Interpol through a very slow, difficult process to try and persuade them to remove the red notice. But you don't get to hear what the case is against you. You often don't get any response at all for several, you know, we've had cases where it's 2 years and still no substantive response to a request to delete a red notice. And that has big problems, for the individuals concerned who are stuck with this thing, not sure how and if they can get rid of it. But also, I think, real problems for Interpol. Because if you don't have some kind of system to hold Interpol to account, you don't spot problem patterns. You don't learn from mistakes. And at the end of the day, the systems for safeguarding Interpol against abuse end up becoming diplomatic systems. How, you know, about keeping, you know, staying friends with members of a club, which is effectively how it works at the moment. It's really a missing a crucial rule of law element. And interestingly, last week, Interpol had its General Assembly in Rwanda, and Loretta Lynch spoke. And in right at the beginning of her presentation, she said, you know, no individual, no organization should be above the rule of law. And I think that applies to Interpol too. I think international organizations need to be accountable. There needs to be a system to keep them within their own rules. As a human rights organization, the thing that got us into this whole topic was the human impact, hearing about the human impact of these abusive red notices. And that's really the focus of most of the interventions from the floor this evening. So I'd like to try to do another film, perhaps ambitious, I guess, based on past performance. Let me see. This is a film of a chap called Benny Wender, who is a West Papuan activist. I'll let him say the rest in his own words. I should say that Benny can't travel here, but because as a result of the red notice, quite probably his US visa has been revoked, hence the need to show a film.
My name is Benny Wender. I'm West Papua independent leader. I'm from West Papua. West Papua is western half of the New Guinea, which is north of Australia, 500 kilometers from north of Australia. West Papua, we are fighting for independence and from Indonesian colonialism. Indonesia occupied our country in 1963. Until today, Indonesia colonized, and the Indonesian killing 500,000 men, women, and children, including myself and some of my family. I'm an eyewitness. from that treatment, then I, when I grow up and I find out that many people are suffering under Indonesian colonialism, I went to school and I studied. And then I beginning to campaign peacefully and leading my people and on the street and coming out on the street peacefully. And I was arrested in 2001, and Indonesia charged me 25 years just because of, first, I'm leader. Secondly, I'm leading peacefully on the street. And
can I just check? Can people hear it? We can't increase the volume. Can people hear it? Because if not, yeah, you can hear it in the audience. Yeah? Okay.
Thirdly, holding our morning star flag, I want to show this morning star flag. This is we call morning star flag. Always. This is the morning star flag. If you're holding this flag in West Papua, you will be arrested and will be in the end up in prison. 25 years, this is the morning star flag. You ended up 25 years in the prison. And I charged, because of my leading this movement, and charged 25 years. No evidence, no weakness, and just simply peacefully. And then I was in the prison three times, they're trying to assassinate me. And no weakness, no evidence, and I ended up in the court many times. So that's why I managed to escape. And there's one thing that in the court case, one of the Australian lawyers, Jennifer Robinson, she witnessed and sitting inside the court, and there's no evidence, no witness, just trying to discriminate the Indonesian law. That's why Indonesia don't like, you know, West Papua campaign for independence, and in the end they want to kill me. I managed to escape, and I came to United Kingdom seeking political asylum in the UK. So then British government, British people allow me to stay in the United Kingdom. And that freedom, I campaigning, I formed a group called Free West Papua Campaign, and I continue to working and with our brother and sister in the UK, mainly British friends and British people. And then after that, 2010, I went to Senegal, and there's an African diaspora conference, and I addressed the conference about West Papua issue. And then after I came back, Indonesia put this red notice. I didn't know red notice or red warrants or Interpol. I didn't know. One time in the morning, I Googled myself in the Google, because there is sometime news coming out. So I put my name, and then suddenly Interpol, you are wanted man. I was shocked and scared, and while I just, then I told my wife, she really scared, she panicked. As a human level, we just sitting there, and, you know, it's really scared, and my children too. Then my children asked me, why, daddy, why are you upset, why are you sad? And my wife just crying, and daddy, this is now, we escape, but then now they want to arrest you in the UK. What going to happen? And I just say, just quiet. And after that, few weeks or few months later, and my lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, came back and said, Benny, I think we need to approach Fair Trial International. They're based in London. They are always handle this kind of cases. So let's do it. My wife said, no, you don't expose yourself. But I said, no, I'm not criminal. I'm fighting for the people, for justice and freedom for my people. So I have to go facing this. That's the same thing what Indonesia doing in, toward my people. Then the end, we decide, okay, let's go. And then we approach the Fair Trial. Then the Fair Trial handing my cases until they approach the Fair Interpol Secretariat. And working, I think, very long time, like nearly two years. But then I got email and a letter from Fair Trial International that your case was removed. And I was, my wife and myself, we jumping up and, you know, worry, Indonesia trying to stop me inside, outside. But now I can continue to work. And I think the Fair Trial worked very great. And people like me, we are voiceless, and other people, like other people who are facing the same treatment, and because we are fighting, they're telling the truth, they're fighting for the justice and freedom, many people out there are same thing. So I hope that fair trial work is really help and free everybody, people who are facing this. I think you are great and you've done a great job. And I hope the other friends already, same thing, that they're already free. And some of you are not free. Please approach the Fair Trial International, and because they have very, very good work. And I'm always grateful and thank you. For
I'm going to stop it there because there's basically lots and lots of gratitude from Benny. It goes on for another minute, but you get the message. What I should say is all of these people that are affected by these Interpol abuses, they are amazing people. So Benny Wender, 3 assassination attempts, and nevertheless he manages to get asylum in Europe despite 3 assassination attempts, being subject to torture. He doesn't just, you know, hang up his campaigning hat and kind of move on with his life and try and rebuild a normal life. He continues to campaign for his people back in West Papua. And to wake up one morning and to see that, that's what he saw on the internet. That's what a public Interpol red notice looks like. To wake up one morning and to see that you are labelled an international wanted criminal, that when your whole campaign is about travelling around the world, raising awareness of how your people back in West Papua that you've had to flee are being killed, mistreated, tortured, imprisoned for 25 years for holding a flag. I mean, it's a horrendous experience, and it seems to me that we really owe it to people like Benny to try and make sure that Interpol can't be misused against them so that they can continue their fabulous work. I'm going to introduce now the second speaker, Sharif Mansour, an Egyptian-American human rights activist who was involved in a case a few years ago, which I will leave Sharif to speak about a bit further. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction and for arranging for this meeting, and thank you all for coming this afternoon. I'll talk today about this from a personal perspective and also from a professional perspective. I'm an Egyptian-American human rights activist, and I'm also the MENA program coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York. And my own experience, which is a story I'm going to tell, starts in 2012. At this point, I was already here in the U.S. in Washington for about 7 years. I moved to D.C. during Mubarak era to escape security threats. I obtained political asylum here in the U.S. And I was working with a democracy promotion group called Freedom House. And in that capacity, we were organizing a lot of trainings, civil society, political activists, on using advocacy skills, including social media, new media, in order to mobilize Egyptian youth and mobilize the population to demand their rights and freedoms. Of course, you can tell this was not something the Egyptian government at the time liked, and I had to be in the U.S. for the duration of my time for 7 years without the ability of going back to Egypt. It wasn't until the revolution started in Egypt, 2011, there was the ousting of Mubarak, that I was able to come back to Egypt. I started the process to open an office for Freedom House in Egypt, and that's when also the Egyptian military started to push back about the promises they made of supporting democracy and human rights and going after journalists and going after civil society organizations. So by 2012, we were at this point in which the government have already started a massive smearing campaign against international NGOs. They've convinced the public of a lot of conspiracy theories about how we are disrupting the country. We have plans to divide the population. And at this point, I was back in Washington. Specifically, I was here on February 1st, 2012. But I had colleagues in Egypt around four. And they were invited for investigation. A prosecutor in Egypt told them, you know, we want to just know what you're doing here. We don't have a specific charge, but we want to chat. And then suddenly we all saw a list of 43 individuals, including myself, majority foreigners from six organizations, five American and one German human rights groups. And the list was published by an Egyptian prosecutor with accusations of operating an NGO without a license and receiving foreign funding without approval from the government, which are both technicalities, civil charges that, you know, even under Egyptian penal code, is not a criminal charge. But the government, in the justification, they've added all sort of accusation, political accusation, that we are implementing an American-Israeli plan to divide the country and to disturb the population, use violence, and all this kind of like outlandish charges. At the point, I was only Egyptian. I was already submitted. I had my green card here, and I was already submitted my citizenship application to become a U.S. citizen. At this point, I was still undecided about whether to be an American citizen or not. At the point, I was seriously thinking of going back to Egypt. There was a lot of hope at the time that things are going to be better for everyone. And, of course, the Arab Spring overall was inspiring for a lot of human rights activists and a lot of political activists. So at the point, I was still undecided about continuing with my citizenship application. And it wasn't until this case started that I had an immediate desire to get my U.S. citizenship. And this was mainly because I felt unprotected at all by being just Egyptian. And while it was funny and sometimes even cool to be named a fugitive or an international fugitive, at the end of the day, you will be under a big threat, your family, your colleagues, especially if you're doing the kind of work that I'm doing, which requires a lot of international travel. I was always, you know, attending seminars, workshops, showing up for trainings across the Middle East. And, of course, that was a big risk at the time. And it's not that I was not expecting risk for the kind of work that I'm doing, and I did have a lot of problems traveling into oppressive environments, and some of it was because I've done work that, you know, criticizes a lot of countries in the region that I'm focusing on. But this was the most kind of direct threat that I felt, and my decision at the time was being an American would allow me a lot more protection in order to reverse this case and in order to help myself and my colleagues who are stuck in this case. I was lucky enough to be in the U.S. at the time, but there were a lot of colleagues who were charged in this case who were outside of Egypt, who couldn't go back to Egypt, or who were in Egypt and were trying to go out of Egypt, or they were just outside and they're trying to travel somewhere else, and they also had the risk of being extradited. So working with the U.S. government, we were able to reach to Interpol, and that's something that, you know, I was lucky because I had those connections. I had been in Washington, D.C., and it was a prominent case for U.S. foreign policy because they were trying to get their American citizens who were stuck in Egypt out of the country, so it was a big outcry in here. So there was a lot of attention about the case. But some of my colleagues who are not American, who are not even Egyptian, were facing trouble traveling to countries in the region, like Tunisia. They were detained in airports. They were sent back, not extradited to Egypt, thankfully, but because of also pressure from the U.S. and other government, there wasn't a serious step taken to extradite those people outside. I want to just say that for this case, it's still a threat. We were all eventually found guilty in Egyptian court, in spite of no evidence whatsoever brought against us, and in spite of an international outcry that included a lot of policymakers and included a lot of human rights groups. But in June 2013, I was found guilty and given a verdict in absentia of 2 years. All of my colleagues were found guilty and was given between 1 and 5 years. Thankfully, those who were in Egypt, who are Egyptian, their penalty was suspended, but they are still under fear, because at any point the government can move against them and remove the suspension of the case. This is on the personal level. Of course, at the time, my feelings were very much that it was too easy for me to be in that position. And that was a big surprise. I didn't have lots of confidence about international systems and international justice, but I expected a little bit more from the Interpol or any international organization to be able to review and have some fair process in which anyone can be indicted and named a fugitive. I think this is something that was a shock to me, and I think it's imperative that no one has to go through the same process. The other thing that I think is important about my case and should be highlighted is that for a lot of reasons, the Interpol should have an accountability process that, you know, allow things to be a little bit more transparent, allow third parties, not just people who, victims who fall through the cracks, but their representative, civil society groups, human rights groups, to have a say, an appeal process that's more transparent and public. I think these are things that will make the Interpol more effective, but also to learn from its lessons. And we've already seen some basic reform happening with some initial reform allowing a little review in the first submission by any government for going after an individual. But we're not sure, I'm not sure how this process is implemented and if there was enough focus on going after governments who abuse the process.
How much time do I have?
Another minute? Okay. I'll focus a little bit more on the professional experience that I have working at the Committee to Protect Journalists, specifically on journalists that have been targeted by the Egyptian government, and I want to highlight two cases. One of them is Al Jazeera journalist Ahmed Mansour, who was stopped in Germany earlier this summer, and for 3 days he was kept in custody until the confusion about his case, even though the Interpol has refused the Egyptian government request of extraditing him, he was kept in custody, and for some unknown reason, they are not sure what happened in his case. And there was a lot of prospect that he would be sent back to Egypt and put in jail on made-up charges. There is another case in which that has already happened. It's an Egyptian journalist, another journalist who was located in Lebanon, and he was extradited back to Egypt last year in the spring, and he was sentenced already to life in prison. His name is Masab, and he was working with a pro-Muslim Brotherhood TV channel that was forced and shut down in Egypt, and he went to Lebanon in order to operate, and his station was shut down, and the Lebanese authorities, acting on an Interpol notice and an extradition request from the Egyptian government, sent him in cuffs to Egypt so that he would be prosecuted and later indicted for a life in prison. These are two examples that I think it's important to highlight because it shows that there is a focus by the Egyptian government on abusing this international mechanism, and also shows that it's not just the theory that this could happen. It has happened, and if it's left without happening, something even worse could happen to any of those individuals. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Sharif. For me, that case is really shocking and illustrative for two reasons. One is that it demonstrates how, you know, even if you have excellent contacts in the political establishment in a country like the United States, it doesn't solve the problem. Even if you can, even if you can persuade Interpol not to publish a red notice. In that case, in many ways, the damage was already done because information was circulated already across Interpol's 190 member countries. And I've heard of people involved in those cases who have been arrested as a result of those, the remnants. Because obviously if you circulate that stuff around the world and it ends up on individual countries' databases, you know, how do you get it back? How do you get rid of it? Basically, it leaves a kind of permanent stamp, a permanent mark on your reputation. And you know, as you know, Sharif, the question then is that whenever you travel again, you might have a little letter from Interpol saying that it rejected the red notice. But it's an extra question for you to ask for every trip overseas. You know, am I going to be stopped? And the other point to me is one that actually your ability to get a positive response from Interpol shouldn't depend on your citizenship. It shouldn't depend on the contacts that you have. And that's why, for us, really, it's about trying to make sure there's a proper system within Interpol to appeal to. The third speaker we have is sat on the front row here, Patricia Paleo, who's an award-winning journalist from Venezuela. And, Patricia, could I invite you to the panel, please? Thank you.
Buenas tardes. Voy a hablar en español porque mi inglés es muy malo. Además, vivo en Miami, que es el peor lugar para aprender inglés.
Good afternoon. I'm going to speak English because because my English is not so good. I've been living in Miami, which is the worst place in the United States to learn English.
Mi historia con Interpol comenzó el 4 de noviembre del año 2005, es decir, hace exactamente 10 años. El gobierno de Hugo Chávez dictó una medida de detención en mi contra. Me acusaron de haber planificado el crimen del fiscal Danilo Anderson, era el fiscal de los casos políticos del gobierno, a quien asesinaron colocándole una bomba en su vehículo.
So my story with Interpol began on November 4th, 2005, exactly 10 years ago. The administration of Hugo Chavez had issued an arrest warrant for me, accusing me of having planned the murder of prosecutor Danilo Anderson.